This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the November 22nd edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Chris Jericho. From Winnipeg to the very top of the wrestling world, I'll chat with the superstar, athlete, entertainer, musician, and now best-selling author. He's live in Studio Q. And what to watch and what to do in these troubling times for U.S. network television, we assemble our Tube team to comb the landscape for entertainment offerings that won't cross your personal picket line. Plus, Charlotte Sullivan is the rising young star of a new Canadian TV series, Across the River to Motor City. She's coming up. Croatia 3, England 2. This is Q. Okay, people, we're deep into week three of the Writers Guild of America strike. And when I say we, I mean all of us, Canadians and Americans, writers and viewers alike. And if the situation for the strikers and networks seems bad, things are about to get a little bit desperate for TV watchers. What with the very last pre-taped episodes of some of your favorite series about to be aired, as in No More Office. So what's the latest? If the strike goes on, what's a poor viewer to do? And given the political nature of all this, what's an ethical viewer to do? Well, Q is about to put these questions and more to our resident experts, the Tube team. Here with me is Dennis McGrath. He's a TV writer and TV blogger based in Toronto. Hello, sir.
Hello, John.
And in Halifax, Tara Thorne, a freelance writer and shameless TV addict. Hello, Tara.
Good day, JG.
Good to have the Tube team here. Dennis, we talked to you last week about the writer's strike and the impact on Canadian writers. What is the latest buzz in the community, and is there any end in sight?
Well, there might be. What is positive is after the Thanksgiving holiday, the producers, the AMPTP, and the writers are going back to the table on Monday, and they've also imposed a news blackout, which means that we're not going to see these dueling press releases, each accusing other of ultimate evil. So maybe that means that they're actually going to get serious.
You see that as a good sign?
I think it's got to be a good sign.
Okay. And what are Canadian writers saying? Is there a new position taken from the Canadian Guild?
No, the Canadian Guild is very much, what the Canadian Guild is doing is trying to tamp down these, stupid things. There's certain people out there saying there's going to be great opportunities for Canadian writers because of this strike. And, the Canadian Guild is saying, no, it's not. We're not trying to scab.
Okay. And Tara, as a TV super viewer, mm-hmm. I'm worried about you.
Buddy.
Are you in withdrawal yet?
No, I'm okay. I think tonight we'll start it because as you just mentioned, The Office is out of new episodes. But a lot of the shows I watch still have four or five left in them.
So what's your plan? What will you do when new episodes stop coming?
I don't know. I guess I'll have to branch out viewing wise, and maybe hit the torrent sites. The DVD box set rental store, catch up on some stuff.
I want to get to, and maybe some Canadian TV.
Oh, yes, also Halifax, I could watch Woman.
Oh, yeah, also.
Oh, yeah, that.
Furthermore, this hour has 22 minutes.
Thank you. We'll get into that in a second. Dennis, there is an opportunity here to catch up on the fall's new shows that you missed the first time around if things are going into reruns. Tell us about one worthy show and repeats that you would check out.
Well, the timing's bad for this because they actually just re-aired their pilot episode, but the one I think that's really worth checking out is called Life. It stars Damian Lewis, who's a Brit, and it's a cop show. It's about a guy that was in jail for a crime he didn't commit, and now he's back on the force, and he's looking for revenge. And it's just a really odd kind of show. It's a very odd character, very compelling, well-acted, well-filmed. I think it's something that really should be checked out.
Tara, a fall show we should revisit in repeat mode?
Actually, you can get it from the start. There's a show coming on Monday. It's called Notes from the Underbelly, and it was a mid-season replacement last year. And it's a sort of family comedy. It's about neurotic couples in various stages of family, and it stars Jennifer Westfeldt, who co-wrote and starred in a great film called Kissing Jessica Stein a few years ago. So it starts Monday. Catch up.
Let me try this out on you guys. If somebody wants to be ethical in terms of supporting their striking brothers and sisters in America. Is the very act of watching American TV, even in repeats, taking some kind of unintentional stand on the strike, is that crossing a symbolic or virtual picket line? Or am I taking that too far?
Well, I mean, it's a funny thing, you know? I mean, personally, I haven't watched anything since the strike started. I actually sat down and tried to watch a network show, and I found I couldn't concentrate. I just didn't want to do it. But at the same time, that's what writers are getting paid well for in the States, is the network broadcast. What they're not getting paid for is internet stuff, and they're not getting paid very much for DVDs.
Right.
So actually, if you go out and rent DVDs, that's probably a little less ethical.
I want to get into that, but I guess what I'm saying is, if everybody stopped watching network American TV, would that not force the networks to at the table to want to resolve this?
It might, yeah. I mean, I'm trying to cook up a post for my blog right now about something they can do surrounding a certain Fox franchise that's coming back in January. It's going to be on for 4 hours a week.
24?
American Idol.
Oh, American Idol. And what are you going to blog about? You can't tell us?
Well, you know, stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Okay. Tara, what do you think about watching American TV?
I think it's fine. I think those episodes are finished and those people have probably been paid. And it's about residuals. Although, Dennis, maybe you can enlighten us a bit. I have heard that in the can doesn't mean that writers necessarily finished them. Like once the strike deadline came down, if episodes of shows were unfinished, producers and other people that were not writers were sort of stuck with finishing them.
Well, it depends. It depends on, there are always non-writing producers on any show. And the problem is that some of those shows, this Last Office that's on the air tonight, it's quite possible that Greg Daniels had nothing to do with editing it. So if it seems a little wonky and off to you, that's probably why.
And if it doesn't.
Well, if it doesn't, it means somebody did a really, really good job of aping Greg Daniels' sensibility.
There is this buzz. We're sort of joking about it. I joked about it in the intro here about the impact of this on Canadian television. But there is a buzz that this strike and American TV going into reruns and repeats could mean that Canadians discover or rediscover Canadian TV. That's something mm-hmm. that Kirsten Layfield was saying about the CBC. Do you think that there's something to that, Tara?
I think so. I think if you've got other options and all you've got is reruns or a new episode of They Can't Get My Hair or The Best Years or something, I think it definitely helps.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was at that CBC launch on Tuesday, and you know what I got to tell you? The slate of shows CBC's got coming up looks kind of sexy. And if there's nothing on, the show I'm just finishing up now called The Border premieres January 7th. And if it's wide open, it's not against 24, it's not against anything else. Yeah, that's going to be very good.
I guess that's your recommendation for what people should be
for the watching. January thing. Yes, right. The Border and Across the River Motor City.
Across the River Motor City. Shan. You. I think you have some involvement in that, and we have one of the stars of that coming up. It's all getting very incestuous. Tara, is there something Canadian that you would recommend, given that it didn't occur to you that there may be Canadian television to watch?
Yeah, I think the show The Best Years. It's sort of a teen drama type thing on Global. I'm not sure if they're still running it, but if they are, check it out.
Let me ask you about these DVD issue, because TV2 viewers are turning to DVDs, obviously. Ironically, that's part of the whole reason for this writer's strike, that they don't feel they're being fairly compensated with regards to that platform. So is that option a kind of political choice too, Dennis?
I think I would be a lot more comfortable about people renting DVDs of Canadian shows or DVDs of British shows than American shows. The weird, I would never suggest this in a million years, but there have been people that made the case that said, now if the writer strike's on, maybe now actually BitTorrenting and downloading illegally, at least that screws both sides equally.
Realistically, people aren't going to stop renting DVDs. No, Tara, is there a TV show that you think works well when it's consumed in one...
Three guesses.
I frying weekend of TV gluttony.
Three guesses. Clear Eyes, Full Hearts, Can't Lose. Friday Night Lights, Dudes. I'm going to say it till it's dead.
You're right, actually, Tara, because I missed that show last season. I've been catching up on DVD.
And
it's
awesome. Yeah, and I saw it in NBC ran this like three-episode marathon one night during the holidays last year, and that's how I got sucked in. Once you acclimate yourself to the ensemble, you'll realize how wonderful this show is.
And you're sure that you're not on the payroll for Friday Night Lights.
I wish.
Since it's virtually a biweekly mention. Dennis, do you think internet TV is a good place to turn?
I don't. I personally don't like the experience of watching internet on the TV. I like actually the TV. That's watching it on the computer screen.
Said the TV writer.
Yeah, but when you watch a download, it steps. It's like the technology is not quite there yet. Maybe 20 years from now, it will be one box, but it's not one box yet.
Tara, there's been word that the network's plans for the future are to bypass writers in one particular option and push through a bunch of new reality shows and game shows. Don't those shows need writers too?
I feel like they do. I mean, a show like Dancing with the Stars probably needs less, but a show like Survivor or The Amazing Race, I mean, these shows need story editors, and they need somebody there who has a sense of narrative there shaping it. So I think that's...
Dennis?
Yeah, well, before I actually got drama writing and comedy writing gigs, I was doing those kinds of shows, and I was writing, believe me.
Did you write that thing that Susan said on the first season of Survivor? Was that you?
No, I didn't. I did a lot of wedding porn.
Oh. Okay, kids, I'm taking it away from this. Is what I'm taking is that TV needs writers, so let's play homage to them with this week's Tube Team Lightning Round. As you recall, this is where I ask you a series of quick questions, and you give me your wry monosyllabic answers. Okay, ready. Tara, are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
TV writing team you're missing most during the strike?
Greg Daniels and company, The Office.
Dennis, same question.
Same answer.
Thank you, Dennis.
Sorry.
Dennis, favorite writer character in TV history?
That's got to be Murray Slaughter from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, just because he's got a great last name, and no network would let you name a character that today.
Tara, same question to you.
Oh, Murphy Brown wasn't a writer, was she?
She wrote.
Dave Barry. Dave's World or whatever that's.
Tara, TV show you'd most want to write for?
The Simpsons or Law and Order Special Victims Unit, because they need my help.
All right, okay. And Dennis, biggest stereotype about TV writers?
That we're kind, tenacious, and giving lovers. Oh, wait, no, that's true.
You're a whore in many ways today.
All right. Hang in there, TV fans. Cube's Tube Team is here for you. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you, sir.
Dennis McGrath is a TV writer in Toronto. Tara Thorne is a freelance writer in Halifax. Together, they are members of Q's Tube Team.
This is Q, the podcast. You can catch Q, the program, weekdays on CBC Radio and several times a day on Sirius 137.
All right, here we go. And now Q enters the ring, tackling that in-your-face, overblown, addictive sportotainment, pro wrestling. You know, whether you're a fan or a foe, you got to admit, those guys are experts at riling people up. Muscle-bound, spandex-clad, modern-day gladiators, comic book heroes and villains come to life, gleefully pushing cultural hot buttons and the boundaries of good taste at times. It's a sport that's all about the spectacle.
The following contest, scheduled for one fall, is for the WCW Championship. Introducing first the challenger from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, weighing 227 pounds, Bruce Jericho.
There it is. Heavyweight Chris Jericho is the first undisputed champion in wrestling history. He's also the lead singer of the rock band Fozzy, an actor and a radio host, and he's just come out with a book entitled A Lion's Tale Around the World in Spandex, all about his own struggles to get to the top in the dangerous and demanding world of pro wrestling. He joins me now in Studio Q. Hello, sir.
Yeah, man. New York Times best-selling author. You have to say
that. Is
that
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's, this book is already the New York Times best-selling book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I feel really, really good about it because, I mean, it took a long time to write this book, a lot of edits and re-edits and shaping and forming. And, I mean, the first thing you can do is you just want to write the best book possible. And then when you actually get something that you like, you want people to read it and people to enjoy it.
It's a very passionate book. It is a very follow your dreams kind of tale because this was your dream. You followed it and you seem to, I mean, to read this book, you just sound like a really happy guy who's gotten what you wanted.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing I thought, like, how rare is it at 8 years old to have this idea, like, I want to be a wrestler? you know, my cousin wanted to be an astronaut. My other cousin wanted to be Indiana Jones. And at 10, they wanted to be a football player. But for me, it was wrestling at 8, wrestling at 10, wrestling at 12. The only other thing I kept that I had in mind was like, oh, it would be cool to be in a band as well. But growing up in Winnipeg, you had the Guess Who and the Crash Test Dummies, and that was about it.
Not Neil?
Neil, but that was way beyond. Yeah, yeah. So it was one of those things that wrestling just seemed a little bit more real to me and something more viable. And that was what I really wanted to do.
Why? Take me back. Let's go back to Winnipeg.
Sure.
Because I love this in the
Let's
book.
Go back.
You sitting on the couch with your grandmother.
Yes.
Watching wrestling. I love that your grandmother was watching, and she was pretty passionate about it as well.
Yeah, right? she was a real quiet lady, and it was actually not even the couch. I vividly remember she had her grandma chair, you know, the cushy chair that no one else is allowed to sit in, right. And I had to sit on the floor. But there was Bugs Bunny on at 5, Hockey Night in Canada on at 7, and then wrestling was on in between. And that was kind of the bridge because I was down with Bugs. I wanted to see hockey. Wrestling, I didn't really know at the time, but my grandma, she was in charge of the TV. Can't change the channel. Grandma's watching wrestling, and if you wanted to watch both other shows surrounding it. But it was interesting because wrestling, when you think about it, is kind of a combination of both those things. It had the athleticism and the hard-hitting action of hockey, but kind of the cartoon character
storyline. Little Bugs Bunny in there as well. Yeah.
That's right. It's a combination of the two, so it's perfect.
So what can you remember when you were watching it as a kid, what it was that resonated for you, that made you think this is what you're passionate about?
That was just it. I mean, even at 8 years old, I love the fact that wrestling was a combination, the fact that, like, hockey was a team sport. And you knew a couple guys growing up in Winnipeg. I knew a couple of the Winnipeg Jets. But I didn't know all of them. If they weren't wearing their uniform, you would never know. But wrestling was, each guy was an individual. And it didn't matter who it was. They all had a character and a personality. And that just really captured my imagination.
You might have known a couple of Winnipeg Jets, but more specifically, your dad was in the NHL. Ted Irvin, the Los Angeles Kings, the Rangers. There wasn't pressure on you to be a good Canadian hockey boy?
No, not at all. Like, I played hockey all through my teenage years and younger years. And quite frankly, I just wasn't really very good. You know, I tried, but my dad was really cool because even though I wasn't going into hockey, I was doing the exact same thing that he did, leaving home at a very young age to go and follow this passion and this dream in the world of athletics. So when I left home at 19 to go to Calgary from Winnipeg to go to wrestling school, my dad was completely supportive of it.
It's interesting because you're a huge star. I mean, you've really hit the top of this field. But along the way, as chronicled in the journey in your book, there's a number of times when you're faced with whether this is what you want to do. And with each one, you check yes and you continue. One of them, when you're really young, you thought this was real. And tell this story because this is quite funny.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, back in those days, there was no internet and you didn't know. I mean, you kind of suspected, but you didn't know for sure. Like, to me, wrestling was pretty much legit.
This is the 80s.
Yeah, the 80s. Yeah, this is probably about 1985 or 1984 or something like that. I used to hang out at the hotel rooms to wait for the wrestlers to come in and try and get their autographs. And there was this guy called Sika, the Wild Samoan. And they used to show him, like, on the beach eating raw fish and, running through the jungle with coconuts and freaking out. Blah, 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 blah. And he had this manager who would speak for him. Sika says he is coming to get you. Blah, 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 blah. Right. And he will give you harm.
Because Sika, you figure, can't speak English.
That's right.
He's the Wild Samoan.
Right. He's from the island of Samoa. So right. I see him at the hotel, and he's not with his manager. Like, oh, my gosh. It's Sika, the Wild Samoan. But it's like the ultimate question. I want his autograph, but how is he going to understand me? So I go up to him and Sika, please you, sign autograph here. And I have this pen making these big swooping motions. Please sign. He looks at me, just looks me dead in the eye. He just goes, F off, kid. And I just couldn't believe it. Not because he told me to F off, but because he spoke English.
Right.
And I was looking around like, did anybody hear that? Sika just spoke English. As if it was like I'd just seen the Loch Ness Monster peek its head up from the water and no one else saw it. I knew the secret of Sika.
But so you find out, so it's like finding out that Santa Claus isn't real. Find out that this, but that doesn't deter you. That didn't deter you.
No, actually, it even made it click more so. I was the ring boy on an early tour, like way before I got into the business, and I roomed with this guy, Catfish Charlie, his name was, who understood that I wanted to be a wrestler and explained me kind of how the matches work and how it was show business and how when a guy won, it was because the promoter said that he was supposed to win. And I kind of suspected it, but when he told me, okay, great. But then I said, well, but when championships are won, you really win, right? He's like, no, the promoters really decide. Like, when Hulk Hogan won the title, he really didn't win? No, the promoter made that decision. And that's when it really hit me, like, Santa Claus is not real. Mm-hmm. I felt like, so, like, oh. But then it really clicked for me, and that's when I really realized, like, I can do this because I'm not the biggest guy in town, but I can have the biggest personality and have the biggest character. And if the promoter tells you who wins or loses, I don't have to worry about getting the crap kicked out of me. I know this is show business now at this point. That's when it really clicked that I can actually do this.
Well, what does it take to make it as a professional wrestler?
You have have to think outside of the box and do things that haven't been done before. You have to be the innovator, not the imitator. And that's what I always tried to do, like make the people get their money's worth when I was on the show.
But you have to be able to act. I mean, you're
absolutely
a performer, right?
Sure.
You have to be something of an acrobat. You have to be physically able to go,
yeah, absolutely. You have to be an athlete in top-notch condition. You also have to have a great personality, and you have to be a great actor. It's all three of those things.
Given that it takes that much, I always wonder about guys like you who clearly have a lot of physical talent, and you know, whether they know it's real or they don't know it's real, there's millions of kids buying that you're the characters that you are. You're a strong enough actor and performer to have them convinced of that. Does it bother you when people, the general public, critics, etc., don't see this profession that you've chosen and hold it in high esteem?
They think that we're a bunch of Cro-Magnons walking around going, fire bad. Like, they don't understand, like all the time, like, wow, you're a wrestler, you can sing, or you're a wrestler, you can act, or you're a wrestler, you wrote a book. Wow, I didn't even think wrestlers could read. And it's like, you know, you think, as you want to knock the block off, you know.
I didn't say that, by the way.
Of course
you're getting
didn't.
A little angry.
I'm getting excited now.
He's going to climb over.
I'm going to just start throwing, I'm going to throw these Burton Cummings album cover against the wall and the Bee Gees. But the thing is, too, is that you know, like, we're like thespians. If Shakespeare was alive today, he'd be writing wrestling plays. And you know, there's a good guy, there's a bad guy, there's a moral dilemma, there's a finish, there's a denouement, all the Shakespearean elements. There's also acting, sad, drama, comedy, in front of a live crowd, backstage, improvising. When I worked with the Groundlings for a year out in Los Angeles, one of the greatest improv comedy troupes of all time. Will Ferrell was a Groundling, Phil Hartman was a Groundling, Sherry O'Terry. And I was up there doing improv with their shows with these guys, and they're like, wow, you're such a good improv. How did you train? I trained by standing in the ring for 20 minutes.
In front of 20,000 people a night.
Right, yeah. Doing improv with The Rock or Steve Austin, just making stuff up as you go.
Does it bother you that you aren't in control of your destiny in terms of the winning, the losing, or even the characters? I mean, this is, as you just talked about, the promoters pulling the strings. So you don't even get to choose when you're a hero or when you're a villain, right?
What?
Or do you?
Kind of and kind of not. I'll explain the reason why. It really does depend on how the crowd is reacting to you. And the promotion usually will go with what the crowd is giving you. So you are in control of your destiny as far as making every single moment that you're on TV or on that stage, making it work and doing the best you can to entertain. When I was working for Ted Turner's WCW, nobody gave a rat's ass about Chris Jericho. I was very low on the totem pole. It was very much of a hierarchy there. The guys that are on top stayed on top. The bottom guys are on bottom. As a result, nobody cared about what I did. And since nobody cared, I said, I don't care. I'm just going to do whatever I have to do to get some kind of a reaction. And I started just going completely over the top, being the biggest coward, complainer, whiner, going to the ring and just saying whatever came to mind. I want you to want me. Like, just totally ripping off Cheap Trick or whatever. But people started getting into it, and then just start calling fans Jerichoholics or I'm a paragon of virtue. People to this day still call me that. As a result, I gained the confidence and the people started getting behind me and they had to do something with me. So you are in control of your destiny to a certain point. You have to connect with the crowd.
Got to ask you about the fans, because I think there's this perception maybe of what wrestling fans are. And then scratching beneath the surface, and we're talking grandmas, kids, business people. There's quite a diversity. How would you describe the wrestling fan?
Well, I think, you know, 15 years ago, the cliche was the, you know, trailer park trash fans, and that was about it. And you did have that element, there's no doubt. I broke my arm working in Knoxville, Tennessee once, and ended up getting cut open because I had a broken arm, and when blood was just pouring out, it looked like Sissy Spacek and Carrie. And there was this stereotypical redneck wearing, like, the overalls and the wife beater, and then he said, that ain't real blood. And then he stuck his finger in and tasted it, and he said, that ain't real blood. And I was like, ugh. But so you did get that stereotype. But nowadays, it's much more of it's a nationwide cultural, I mean, it's part of the cultural fabric of North America.
You have been around the world. And talking about the fans, I'm curious if fans react differently when you're in different countries. For example, a villain in Mexico becomes a hero in Japan. Or are the fans pretty much the same as wrestling fans around the world?
You know, that's a great question, because as the cultures are different, so is the wrestling fans are different. I mean, in Mexico, it's much more, wrestlers are real-life superheroes. It's more of a cartoon. They all wear masks and capes and things along those lines. And people really get excited. I remember one time I was wrestling in Acapulco, and I was working as a heel, and the people were really
getting
mad at me.
Explain what a heel is.
A heel is a bad guy. Yeah. My name was Corazón de León, Lionheart. And they started chanting Corazón de Pollo, Chicken Heart, which I thought, that's A for effort. That's good originality. And then I get hit in the face with this cup of water that's warm and salty. It's not water. It's actually some urine in a cup. And I'm thinking, how much does this guy hate me to actually pull out his Walt Weatherby and actually pee in a cup during the match and throw it at me? And then there's a big scuffle at the ringside, and the same guy was charging the ring, I later found out, with a gun. He wanted to actually shoot me. So they were really upset there in Mexico. In Japan, kind of a different world, much more reserved and quiet and just watching. And you'd be out there having this kick-ass match, and nobody...
But huge still, right?
Huge. Oh, yeah, in front of 15,000 people in Budokan. But there'd be no noise. So you did get different
styles.
You
have to kind of prepare for each place
you
that you're going to go into.
And once you kind of learn how each territory is, that helps you with your wrestling as
well. We wanted to get the perspective of a person who's one of wrestling's biggest fans, poet and wrestling book editor of ECW Press, Michael Holmes. Here's some of what he had to say about the way wrestling reflects our culture.
Pretty much everything that gets written and broadcast on wrestling TV is a response to something that's happening in contemporary culture, in politics, in the world today. As recently as a couple of years ago, there was a great character, a great heel in World Wrestling Entertainment called Muhammad Hossein. He was essentially a Muslim terrorist, playing off the fears of American culture and American popular culture, and he represented every stereotype of the evil Arab that you could ever imagine. Why he was great, however, was because of the way that the character was written, and the man who performed him actually based the character in a lot of political realities of everyday life for a Muslim in America.
That was Michael Holmes, who wrote a book of poetry all about the art and spectacle of wrestling entitled Parts Unknown. Chris, do you have a sense of how villains and heroes have changed over the years in wrestling and reflected what's going on in society outside the arena?
It really has, and that was actually a really good quote, because in a lot of ways he's right. It is indicative of society. In that, back when I first started, being a long-haired, pretty boy, quote-unquote, good-looking guy, that was instantly a babyface, a good guy. As the years kept going on, what used to be the good guy started getting hated. In 96, when I started in WCW, I knew I was going to be crucified, because I came out there as that, yay, I'm happy, and I got long hair, and people would be like, screw this guy. Because when Steve Austin started coming out, it was the era of the anti-hero, which, to describe it, it's like, remember when Terminator, the first Terminator, you were scared to death of him. The second one, you started to like him.
Kind of like him,
because he was so much more interesting than the good guys. So the bad guy became the good guy, and the good guys became the bad guy. It all turned into an area of gray. So nowadays, as our society, to get over as a good guy, you're swearing, Austin drinks beer, he's giving the finger, and people love that. So the roles have really changed.
Is it always reflective, reactive, or would you actually go as far as to say that wrestling has something, plays an educational role in terms of, in the quote there, Michael Holmes was hinting at, perhaps, that showing an everyday Muslim or something?
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, it was a perfect time to have the Muslim heel. And the thing was the brilliant about that
he's
character.
He's still a heel, though, and
he's
still a
heel. But here's
right?
the reason why. He wasn't coming out there saying, I am a terrorist, which is what guys used to say back in the 80s when they were playing the evil Russians in the Cold War, or the Japanese back in the 50s and 60s. He was saying, I am persecuted for being an Arabic citizen. I'm being persecuted by you people who are stereotyping me to be a terrorist. I'm not a terrorist. I'm just misunderstood. And then people were booing, because obviously he was hinting that, but also saying that it's your fault that I'm a bad guy because you're turning me into a bad guy. People don't like being accused of things. They don't like being told what to do. And that's one way to always get a reaction from the fans.
He was still the enemy, though, right?
Of course he was. Completely the enemy. And that's the way they played it off. And it was actually a really good character for a short period of time. But then its shelf life was kind of over very quickly, as most stereotypes in the job are.
We have seen a lot of tragedy lately in the lives of wrestlers, things going very, very wrong, including the murder-suicide tragedy of Chris Benoit, who you worked with. What have the reactions been like inside the business? Will it change anything about the business?
Well, I mean, I didn't just work with Chris. He was probably my best friend I ever had in the business. And, writing my book, I mean, I finished my book in May, and all the stuff happened in June, and I mean, he's all over the book in a very positive sense. He was nothing but a positive influence on me.
You're the other Chris.
Yeah, exactly. Calgary Kids, the other Chris. So I had to address that at the beginning of the book. I wrote a little foreword just explaining that the guy that I'm talking about is not the guy who did these things in the last weekend of his life. Because I wanted to clear that up. This book is a very positive, humorous book, and I didn't want that cloud hanging over it. You know, and having said that, I don't know, really, no one knows what happened with Chris, and I'm sure there's a lot of factors, but in a way, I think it's good that it's brought wrestling under fire to a certain extent, because it will clean up some of the problems. And the thing is, I think guys have made it a habit when it's not necessary. I was never, you know, a steroid user as far as, I mean, I had to think big character-wise. I was never going to be a big guy, no matter how much drugs I did. I trained hard. I'm bigger than the average Joe, whether I'm on steroids or not, because I work out hard, and as do most of the guys in the business. So I think if you just eliminated the steroids, let's say you made it illegal, where if you get caught with 1 gram of steroids, you go to jail, or one dose, or whatever the hell it is, I guarantee guys would stop doing it, and that would be it. And you know what? Nothing would change.
You said you've had a perspective on this being an ephemeral, a short-lived career. And in fact, your advice to young wrestlers would be to save and recognize that. And so I wonder where you're at now. If you have a hankering to go back in the ring, I know your fans would want you back there. I mean, you're focusing on your rock band, your book, obviously. You're doing some acting, a radio show. Do you feel the pull of wanting to go back into the ring? Are you like a hockey player that has to stay involved in the business because you miss it?
When I left the business because I was really burned, mentally burned. I never said I was retiring. I just needed to take a step back. I had all these other projects that I wanted to work on. The reason why I do so many things is I never put any limits on myself of what I could or couldn't do. If I felt there was something I could do, I would go for it and get it going and make things happen. And if you believe in your abilities and believe in what you do, you can make it happen. Also, having said that, after I finished writing this book, it made me realize how much of a passion I had for the sport, how much I love it, and how fortunate I was to have taken it as far as I did. I will eventually go back. The time is right now. I think I could be the last of my generation who came through the business the way that I did, who still can work.
It's good talking to you. Thanks for
coming. It's great, man. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
The Undisputed Champ, Chris Jericho, joining me in Studio Q. His book is called A Lion's Tale. That's tale as in a story. Around the World in Spandex. It's published by H.B. Fenn and Company.
You've downloaded Q, the podcast with Gian Gameshi, highlights from CBC Radio 1's daily cultural magazine, and I am not Gian Gameshi.
It's November 22nd, a date that, even 44 years later, rings in the public consciousness as a tragic day in the history of the United States, if not the entire world. Back in 1963, schools in Canada closed to mark the death of President John F. Kennedy. And even the just-defeated Prime Minister of Canada, John Diefenbaker, was quick to eulogize the man with whom he'd shared a difficult relationship. The aftermath of the Kennedy assassination has also captured the imagination of Dennis McGrath, I think I know that name, and Michael DiCarlo, co-writers of Across the River to Motor City, a six-part Canadian murder mystery set in the Windsor-Detroit area from 1963 to the present day. Actor Charlotte Sullivan is a cast member of the series, and she joins me live in Studio Q. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your debut tonight.
I know, it was tonight, which is really very professional.
You forgot
of me.
It was tonight?
I just forgot. I've had a lot going on. But yeah, no.
You film tonight. These things and then you forget about them.
I know, it's weird promoting them because it was a year ago that we shot it.
It was a year ago?
Mm-hmm.
And you shot it in Detroit, right?
We did. We got to shoot in Tiger Stadium.
I want to ask you about that. First, set this up for people. Across the River to Motor City begins on the day of the Kennedy assassination. Tell us what sets the story in motion and where you fit in.
Well, the story begins on this day, November 22nd, and I play a flight attendant named Katie Wilton, who she goes off to work and, you know, the terrible news of what has happened sort of paralyzes America, and, you know, people can't get out on, they're on the streets, everything's blocked, no one has any answers. I mean, it's almost like going back to September 11th in a sense, because could you imagine if you had a heart attack on that day and trying to go to the hospital? Like, there's no answers. People, there's so much, everyone's sort of fixated on this one moment in history. So it begins on that day, and I go missing. And for 40 years, nobody has any answers as to where I am or if I'm still alive or what's happened to me.
You're kind of the Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks. Of this, you don't remember her.
No,
she's
God.
The series in the 90s called Twin Peaks. So she disappeared, and she becomes the text of the series is sort right. of searching for the mystery of Laura Palmer. I'll try and avoid references that we don't. That's interesting enough. This happened way before you were born. Mm-hmm. What struck you about this period of history that you're recreating and exploring in the series?
The 1960s for me are this like one of the most romantic times in history, just in terms of like women's bodies and their clothes. And that for me, it was great coming to work and just getting to transform into this really sort of different era with beautiful clothes.
Now, how'd you do that? You're 24 years old, so how do you turn yourself into
I'll never tell my age. That might not be my age. You don't know if that's real.
I have no idea.
How did I do that? I came,
She's
I showed up.
She's 18 or 30. We're not
13
sure.
I'm 13 years old. Yes. No, I showed up to work in pajamas, and then they, you know, I had this really beautiful makeup artist called Robbie O'Quinn, and she, you know, false eyelashes and just really, I mean, she's so talented. We had a gorgeous costume designer named Patrick Antosh, and I didn't have to do anything. Like, it was just really easy because when you're able to transform into a character, it almost like, you don't have to think, really, because everyone else has done the work for you. You just show up. Everything's already done. You walk differently.
Show up in your pajamas, apparently.
I did, yeah. I did. I showed up in my pajamas, and then by the end of it, I was in, like, these, I mean, just the most beautiful and intricately woven, I mean, uniforms. And
you mentioned women's bodies mm-hmm. in the 60s. Tell me more about what you mean by that and how you saw yourself transforming into a woman of the 1960s in that sense.
Well, when I showed up for fitting, the costume designer, Patrick Antosh, said, don't lose any weight. If anything, gain weight. And that was the first time I've ever been subjected to that in my career. It's normally, you know, the other way around. And it was just such a time when you know, you could be curvy and comfortable in your own skin, and they even accentuated the curves. I just thought, like, it's just in terms of fashion-wise and on a superficial level, just incredibly striking, just all the patterns and the way it just formed on a woman's body. So for me, it's just, I love clothes very much, so being able to,
and it was liberating that you could actually eat.
That I could
eat. On set,
it was amazing. I was like, "Wow, this is the first time that I've actually been told not to lose weight." That's hysterical.
Well, it's I think a lot of people will discover you through this series, and it's getting good reviews, and so kudos, and there's
Thank
excitement
you.
Around it. But this isn't the first time. I mean, looking at your resume or your IMDb, which is probably where we found out your age, by the way. You see, you can't hide these things
lies,
in the age.
But you don't know if that's real or not. It could be fake.
Right. Yes, it could be. It could be. Absolutely. Everything could be fake.
Absolutely.
But you've been acting for a long time.
Yeah.
You started when you were 11 years old or doing television.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how that happened.
Well, as a child, I was really obsessed with Tim Burton. And I was like, to the point it was ridiculous. I was memorizing Edward Scissorhands. I knew every scene and every part. I was rewinding, and I just had this fixation with Tim Burton, and I wanted to do something like that. And my mom is a single mom who, God bless her, but she didn't know what to do. I mean, we don't have anyone in the family that's in the business. So it was sort of something that I kept begging to do. And, you know,
you wanted to be in a Tim Burton movie.
Yes, I did.
How did you get, what was your in?
Honest to God, an agent saw me, and I guess I was being really cocky. I don't know.
Saw you on the street?
We were going to go see a movie, and someone came up to me, and we were struck up a conversation and wanted to meet with me again. So we met up again, and I was really very naive. I didn't really know. We don't have anyone in the family that knows anything about it. So went in a really very green, and she asked me to read something, and I just read it and told her all my aspirations, and oh God, I think it was pretty cocky, very embarrassing.
You were in Harriet the Spy.
Yes.
You did a Kung Fu the Next Generation show, right?
You really do have my resume.
What was your favorite, although apparently it could be all lies, we don't know. Was your favorite acting role from childhood, Charlotte?
I'd have to say I did this IMAX film with Paul Cox. He directed it, and it was the first time they'd done a storyline in an IMAX film. Normally they're documentaries. And I mean, it was just such a huge and amazing experience. They only have two IMAX, at that time, only had two IMAX cameras in the entire world, and we were using both of them. And I got to just learn a lot, and I was the only child on set.
How old were you then?
I was 12. And that, for me, I think being the only kid on set, that was, I guess it makes you incredibly resilient, just because I didn't have anyone to play with. And so it was really great to learn. I think that no matter how big it is or small it is, role you play, every time you're on set, you're learning something. So that was the biggest learning experience for me.
When people, on a technical level. What did you learn? How did being a kid actor and then continuing to act through your teens inform who you are now as an actor? Do you think that there's something that you know about the business that somebody who maybe starts in their late teens as opposed to at the age of 11 being on TV
well, I don't know.
Doesn't know?
That would be really... I think as a child, you're forgiven for not knowing just because you're new. Whereas when you're older, I guess people automatically assume you should know certain etiquette on a set and what have you. As a kid, you know, I was learning where to put my mark, just technical things, you know. So... to start now, I think I'd be incredibly overwhelmed and really, really very worried about, you know, making a wrong impression. Whereas just as a kid, you're just...
You feel like you have a confidence now? Because
I feel very... I'm a very confident person. I was raised to be incredibly confident, thank God to my mom. But yeah, I can't imagine starting now. I think I'd be very scared.
I mean, you mentioned the audition process and you mentioned that the weight and there is a focus when one reads about you in the past and even today, you know, the reviews about this show that's coming on your beauty, on your attractiveness. And I wonder... So here you are. You're a young Canadian. You're making a face. You know this already. You don't need to make, but I wonder about this in terms of the roles that you want to play and the roles that you get. Looking again at the roles you've played, I'm seeing sexy wife, spin instructor, sweetie, right? These are some of the characters you've played. Mm-hmm. Is that comfortable for you? Is that something, or do you already feel like that you have to fight against your beauty?
I think I that's kind of it's an awkward question to answer, just because, you know, I am constantly changing the way I look all the time. I'm dyeing my hair red, black, green, and I think I think you do it sort of because you want to try other things. And with my black hair, all I played was like street youths and gothic girls, which is great, but you know, you did it and then you move on. And you know, with blonde, there's a certain thing that I do play, but this will change. And you just, I think that as an actor, you are a blank canvas and you can be anything. So when you go into that room and you're going to audition for it, you got to show them the character is already there. So if they see you as a really attractive person or not so attractive person, they'll sort of pigeonhole you in that sort of area where, I don't know, I just think that I guess they don't really have that much of an imagination, so you have to go in there, be the character already, even if it's a crazed.
Good for you. You do have that confidence. Look at you.
I get. Well, I hope so.
So you're so far. You're still living in Toronto.
I kind of go back and forth.
Go back and forth
to Los Angeles.
Where do you want to go with all this? This is the question we'll play back to you in 15 years.
Where
you know?
Do I want to go with
and
this?
And so say this is what you.
Well, I think it would be really limiting to say that all I would want to do is act. I just because there's moments in my time in my life where I get really like so annoyed with it, and it can be incredibly superficial. It is a superficial medium. I would love to do more behind the scenes. I think that is where I'm being pulled towards. So this is sort of training ground for me. And I think the best thing to do in order to do the behind the scenes is know what it's like to be in front of the camera. And so I think I want to do
more. What does that mean? You want to write?
I want to produce.
Direct,
and, yeah,
produce?
I do. I really do.
This series, Across the River from Motor City, there's already talk that there's going to be a second series that is going to... Have you heard this?
Yeah, they're talking about prequel.
Because I was going to... I was out.
Because I'm...
You're already... Yeah, you're dead.
I know.
Right? So how...
I know, because
what happens to Katie Wilton?
I know, they came to me and they said, we're gonna do a sequel. I said, well, that's fine. That's great. But I'm dead, my darling. So
not so good for you.
Not so good for me. They said, no, we want to do a prequel. We want to set it in Cuba and have it be around the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I mean, I'm not holding my breath, but that would be really amazing. Get to shoot in Cuba.
You'll have to and you'll have to play even younger, right?
I guess
so.
which is
fine because you have no age.
I'm ageless. It's really
right,
the truth.
Right. you know, it's a good series. It's really interesting.
It doesn't look.
This is a strange thing to say. It doesn't look like a traditional Canadian series.
That's what everyone's saying.
I don't know
very nice
even what I mean by that, but I do know that that's what I see it and go.
Well, there's a staple to Canadian television. I think then you see it and you go, oh, well, that's Canadian. Well,
what do you think makes this different?
Well, we had a really talented group of people. We had Michael DiCarlo, whom I can't say enough great things about. We had David Green, a cinematographer, and they just created this really beautiful painting, and the colors are really intricate and gorgeous, and I don't know, it's got a different vibe. I mean, it is because you're going back in time 40 years, and so it has to be sort of that gritty, raw vibe, but I think that's what's so different about it.
It also really feels like that Winnipeg, really feels like that Windsor, Detroit axis, that to the two sides of the Ambassador Bridge.
I'm glad you saw that.
You can really feel that. Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in.
Oh, God, thank you for having me. God bless.
Absolutely. Across the River to Motor City, starring Charlotte Sullivan, debuts tonight on City TV. Now, it debuts everywhere except Winnipeg, where they got a preview on Monday. It already was on Monday.
That's not fair.
So no spoilers from the PEG, and lucky Winnipeg people. Maybe you will benefit from the writer's strike. Maybe that in America, this is one of the examples of what people will be
watching
on Canadian TV. If there's a benefit to the writer's strike, it'll be for you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.